uranium that's mined in Niger. And that has been exploited for over four decades by the French nuclear fuel cycle group by the name of Orano, formerly Areva.
You're listening to Economic Divide. This series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Section of the program. There have been lots of activity when it comes to BRICS nations, lots of news. I'm sure you'll agree. Well, by default, one of the issues is going to be de-dollarization, which is a consequence, at least when it comes to BRICS. But are these just myths or realities? That's what we want to find out in this section of our program. All right, let's get started. First up, we're going to take a look at something that happened under the umbrella of the New World Order, anti-Russia, U.S., EU sanctions. They confiscated Russian assets. The U.S. Treasury had a big part of that. Gold and foreign exchange reserves were confiscated to the amount of $302.5 billion was the value of that. Next up, another factor that has happened is the U.S. dollar weaponization, as I said, a consequence. Countries panicked because the U.S. dollar was being weaponized against them, possibly. So they went ahead and converted their foreign reserves, and two of the options they had, yuan and gold, is what they converted their assets into. To continue with the trend of de-dollarization, national currencies have been now used in bilateral trade. Payment systems and cards integration also have been put in place. And financial messaging system accommodates that in order for the de-dollarization to continue. Then we have de-dollarization in the BRICS countries. Okay, so there's what's called a BRICS Pay, which was introduced years ago. You have a single payment system in order to make sure that dollar is not used. And then you have what's called this cloud platform, where it connects the national payment systems in order for that to happen, along with the common currency, which was the last one. Now, SWIFT replacement is a big one. Russia, China, and Iran, they each have their own payment systems, as you can see over here. BRICS has said it's going to introduce that in 6 months, and everybody's looking forward to see whether that is going to be discussed, which I'm sure it will be, in the upcoming BRICS summit. And after we look at what has happened over here, as you can see, I've left these on the wall for you in order for you to review them to make sure that you're not missing something, because there's a whole lot of information here, you know, from SWIFT replacement to BRICS de-dollarization and the de-dollarization trend that we talked about in the beginning, and how the U.S. dollar was weaponized along with the anti-Russia, U.S. and EU sanctions. Okay? Now let's see whether BRICS has something to stand on. This are the BRICS stats, of which 23% is the share of the global economy of BRICS countries. And that's a lot when you consider it's the entire world. And then 25% share of global investment. A quarter of global investment happens from BRICS countries. Think about that. Then the share of global trade in goods, 18%. And then the big one, wait for it, it's coming up. And here it is, 33.4% of the global GDP, which adds up to $26.01 trillion. That's how much the share of the global GDP BRICS countries has. So BRICS does have something to stand on, which obviously is going to go through with things like de-dollarization. All right. Before we get to our guest, let me introduce Mahdi. Mahdi is going to join us now to tell us more about what's going to be coming up in his section, the quick take section. All right, Mahdi, what do you have coming up for us?
Thanks, Gove. It was really difficult to pick the important ones, but the introduction of a common currency is one of them, which may or may not happen in the upcoming summit in South Africa.
All right, great. Thank you so much for that. All right, let's get our guests back into the picture and see what they think about some of these issues we've been covering. We have Julia Gambina rejoining us, Argentinian economist and investigative journalist. Julia Gambina, welcome back. When you take a look at what's called the unipolar world, it is said that it's collapsing and a multipolar world is formed along with the participation of Africa, which is not mentioned as much. Last year alone, you had 19 African countries that applied for BRICS membership because they want a completely new economic relationship as opposed to the West. Is this what we're looking at when we mention the world, a new world order, at least part of it?
Well, what is happening is a disarmament of globalization deployed for four decades between the 80s, 90s and recent years. The disorder promoted by the unilateral sanctions of the United States and its global partners, especially Europe, is motivating new frameworks of international relations that intervene in the reorganization of the world system.
All right, this reorganization that he's talking about is important here. We have discussed that throughout the program in one way or another. Let me bring in Vinicius Rodriguez Vieira, who rejoins us. Vinicius, welcome back. We're looking at the African participation when it comes to this new economic relations that they want to have within the BRICS context, because they don't want to deal with the Western financial system as much. And of course, the unipolar world, how it's collapsing, along with the multipolar world, which is being promoted through BRICS. How do you think this is all going to work out? Is this what we're looking at overall in terms of a new world order?
I think we are not yet there. There's still a long way until we rebuild an alternative world order in which there would be far more participation from the global south, particularly from the democracies of the global south, like Brazil, South Africa are good examples. In case of Africa, I think definitely move towards a real multipolar world in which Africa is incorporated as an independent voice in world politics will be the invitation by President Lula when Brazil will have the G20 next year to the meeting here in Rio de Janeiro. The African Union will be invited to join G20 as a member, like the European Union is of G20. Therefore, that would be a very strong step towards a true multipolar world, because it's ridiculous to think that a large continent like Africa has just one representative in such an important forum like the G20, namely South Africa.
BRICS is one of those alternative routes to Western hegemony. The group is comprised of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. But currently, a host of other nations are vying to join the club. Apart from Iran, Argentina, and Saudi Arabia, nearly 20 African nations have applied to become a BRICS member or are contemplating to do so. Russia, China, and Brazil have turned to greater use of non-dollar currencies in their cross-border transactions. Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates are actively exploring dollar alternatives, and central banks have sought to shift more of their currency reserves away from the dollar and into gold. Furthermore, the Asian Clearing Union, ACU, a nine-member group of central banks, including those of India, Pakistan, and Iran, has decided to launch a new cross-border financial messaging system in June as an alternative to SWIFT.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Matti Apposian. BRICS 7 could be the quickest route to a multipolar world. The upcoming BRICS summit is set to establish a criteria for expansion into the bloc. Why will it be called BRICS 7 and not BRICS? Because two additional members may officially join and bring the total number of members from the current five to 7. The introduction of the BRIC 7 would allow the bloc to introduce 2 additional members to grow its GDP and economic influence. Subsequently, these 2 factors could completely shift the geopolitical power balance. And which 2 countries, may you ask? Prior to the summit, the talk was that Saudi Arabia and Indonesia were in the running, which could add another $2 trillion to BRICS GDP. Here are the BRICS members' GDP figures and the ones that have applied for membership. If you add the GDP figures, the grand total you would get would be $35.15 trillion. Here's why the end of the dollar dominance is here. For those non-believers, India has convinced 22 countries to trade in rupee and to ditch US dollar. BRICS members, India, China and Russia, are convincing other developing countries to trade in their respective native currencies and not the US dollar. Still think that is not enough to challenge the US dollar and its dominance? Maybe the new BRICS currency will do that. Highly anticipated to be unveiled in the upcoming BRICS summit, although there are reports that indicate it may not happen at this summit. Nevertheless, as the US dollar loses value due to growing regulations, inflation, and the rise of BRICS, a new global currency can start making its push to the top. And this currency will be backed by gold. As such, the BRICS nations aim to provide a tangible and stable backing diverging from the credit-based nature of the US dollar. And the engine behind BRICS that will power countries with loans and finances, especially for infrastructure projects, is the New Development Bank. So that is it for this section of the program.
The United States and Europe are digressing in the world standing, at least in terms of their economic standing. They are not in the lead when it comes to the revenue generation compared to the new BRICS formation. Although it will take a bit of time for BRICS to dismantle, the destructive role in some sense of the West and the U.S. in the way that their economies actually went after developed nations, let's say, such as the Islamic Republic, well, you're going to see that BRICS is going to be successful because they have a larger share when it comes to the world GDP, something that we covered. But how fast this is going to happen, I believe the BRICS upcoming BRICS summit will determine the time frame of how all those things will happen and move forward with it. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for tuning in. From Omi Kavitawe and the team, it's goodbye until the next Economic Divide.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
The hunt is on for survivors after at least 6 people died when a boat sank in the English Channel on Saturday, 12th of August. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Observer has covered this story and tells us more. The government's controversial asylum policy faced renewed criticism on Saturday, 12th of August, when at least six people died after a small boat crossing the English Channel capsized and sank. Another two people are still believed to be missing after the sinking of the boat, prompting fresh calls for the government to urgently introduce safe routes for asylum seekers to prevent further tragedies. As the search for survivors continued, anger quickly switched to the Home Office's reluctance to introduce measures that would deter migrants from risking their lives crossing the world's busiest shipping lane. The tragedy also created a dreadful ending for Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's Small Boats Week, which was meant to reinvigorate his stuttering strategy to tackle channel crossings, but has been repeatedly marred by blunders and humiliation, including the forced evacuation of the BB Stockholm barge and record small boat arrivals. News of the latest tragedy emerged in the early hours of Saturday, 12th of August, when a passing ship raised the alarm that an overloaded boat was in difficulty off the coast of Saint-Gat near Calais in France. In the hours that followed, British and French coast guards rescued about 65 people from the vessel. France's maritime prefecture of the Channel and the North Sea said it believed two were possibly still missing at sea. Of those rescued, six were recovered in a serious condition, one of whom was flown by helicopter to a Calais hospital and later died in hospital. The remaining five were taken on a boat but subsequently died. Reports from the French lifeboats arriving at the scene described numerous people in the area, many screaming for help. The Dover lifeboat quickly joined the rescue operation, with 10 survivors later seen being brought off the vessel as it returned to Kent, some on stretchers, though the extent of the injuries and exact numbers remained unclear. Enver Solomon, chief executive of the Refugee Council, said the latest preventable deaths underlined the need for the Home Office to act. These tragic incidents can and must be prevented. We know that people risk their lives to cross the English Channel as a direct consequence of safe routes being so limited and so ineffective. But instead of putting in place these routes and treating those seeking refuge with compassion and fairness, the government has introduced draconian and unworkable new laws that slams our door in the face of vulnerable men, women and children. Steve Smith, the chief executive of refugee charity Care for Calais, said the terrible loss of life demonstrates yet again the need for a system of safe passage to the United Kingdom for refugees. Later, the charity Freedom from Torture released a statement accusing ministers of hostile attitudes towards refugees. The current Home Office position pledges to bring in new routes, yet it is unclear when and in what form it would do so. We are committed to providing routes, including exploring new routes, to safety for vulnerable people crossing the globe. But we must first grip the rise in illegal migration and stop the boats, says the Home Office's website. Following Saturday's tragedy, a statement from the Home Office focused on tackling people smugglers rather than reviewing its current approach. This incident is sadly another reminder of the extreme dangers of crossing the English Channel in small boats and how vital it is that we break the people smugglers business model and stop the boats, the website said. Britain's Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, chaired a meeting with Border Force officials on Saturday morning, 12th of August, and described the incident as a tragic loss of life. In France, an investigation has been opened by the Boulogne Prosecutor's Office. The French National Assembly member for Calais, Pierre-Henri Dumont, said authorities were interviewing the migrants who were able to speak and not too unwell to establish what had happened and where they had come from. On Saturday night, rescuers were still scouring the water for survivors and bodies. A French Navy aircraft and a helicopter had been deployed to help in the search. On Thursday, 755 people crossed the English Channel in small boats, the highest daily number so far this year, taking the total since 2018 past 100,000. Rescue crews said it was the seventh time last week that they had had to pull people from the water. Although the incident happened in French territory, it is normal for British and French rescue teams to work together to save as many people as possible. The sinking came just a day after fresh Home Office humiliation when asylum seekers on the BB Stockholm barge were evacuated following the discovery of Legionella bacteria in the water supply. The worst channel sinking involving migrants occurred in November of 2021 when at least 27 people died after a dinghy sank whilst heading to the United Kingdom from France. Four people died at sea while trying to cross the English Channel in December. The Home Office's position on safe and legal routes also says, as the Illegal Migration Bill sets out, an annual number of people coming through on safe and legal routes will be set by Parliament and in consultation with local authorities. The London Evening Standard has also covered the same story. At least six people have died and more than 50 others rescued when a boat carrying migrants sank in the English Channel. British and French crews have been involved in the large-scale operation after a vessel got into difficulty off the coast of Saint-Gat near Calais in France on Saturday morning, 12th of August. Around 65 people are thought to have boarded the boat, with two possibly still missing at sea, France's Maritime Prefecture of the Channel and the North Sea said. Six were recovered in a serious condition, one of whom was flown by helicopter to a Calais hospital and later was declared dead. An updated statement said the other five individuals who were taken in by boat had also died. A passing ship first raised the alarm that a vessel was sinking near Calais in the early hours of Saturday morning, 12th of August, the prefecture said. Some 22 people were rescued and dropped off in Dover, Kent, including by a Royal National Lifeboat Institution crew, which was launched shortly before 4 a.m. on Saturday, and a British chartered ship. At least 36 other survivors were collected by French boats and taken to the port of Calais, as well as five people who died. Home Secretary Suella Braverman chaired a meeting with Border Force officials later on Saturday morning, 12th of August, describing the incident as a tragic loss of life. Suella Braverman is being updated on latest developments in the operation. A British government spokesperson said these deaths are devastating and our thoughts are with the victims' families and friends at this time. The incident is sadly another reminder of the extreme dangers of crossing the English Channel in small boats and how vital it is that we break the people smugglers' business model and stop the boats. Rescue teams from Folkestone and Langdon Bay, along with paramedics from South East Coast Ambulance Service, have also been sent to respond, the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency has confirmed. A French Navy aircraft and helicopter has been deployed, assisted by a number of boats and merchant vessels, a British chartered ship, and the British Coast Guard. An investigation has also been opened by the Boulogne Prosecutor's Office. It comes after 755 people crossed the English Channel in small boats on Thursday, the highest daily number so far this year, confirming the total since 2018 has surpassed 100,000. Some 343 people in six boats were detected crossing the Channel on Friday, according to Home Office figures.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry has announced the start of a process to unfreeze Iran's assets blocked in South Korea due to American sanctions.
The process for releasing several billion dollars of the Islamic Republic of Iran's assets, which had been illegally frozen in South Korea by the United States for several years, has started. Iran has received necessary guarantees that the U.S. will abide by its commitments in this regard.
The ministry said the decision on how to utilize these unfrozen resources lies with the Islamic Republic of Iran, adding that the assets will be used to meet the country's needs. That followed claims that Iran's access to these assets will be limited. Meanwhile, under the deal, a number of Iranians, whom the foreign ministry statement said are held in the U.S. under the false accusations of circumventing sanctions, will be released. The ministry said several American prisoners in Iran, whose freedom was sought by Washington, are still in Tehran. Iran's mission at the United Nations put the number of those prisoners at 5, that they have been released to house arrest in preparation for a prisoner swap between the two countries. And Iran's Vice President for Political Affairs, Mohammad Jamshidi, said the American prisoners will leave the country after Iranian assets are fully transferred to Tehran. It came after reports by U.S. media outlets, including the New York Times and the CNN, quoted sources as saying that Washington will allow the transfer of nearly $6 billion of Iran's assets in South Korea to an account in the Central Bank of Qatar. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has welcomed the prisoner swap, but said the U.S. will keep up sanctions against Iran.
In any event, in any respect, Iran will not be receiving any sanctions relief. And in any instance where we would engage in such efforts to bring Americans home from Iran, Iran's own funds would be used and transferred to restricted accounts such that the monies can only be used for humanitarian purposes, which, as you know, is permitted under our sanctions. There's an exemption for humanitarian that's there from the start.
The Islamic Republic has in the past rejected U.S. claims of sanctions exemptions for humanitarian purposes. Iran says the sanctions are inhumane and illegal and has directly affected its people's life. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the 2015 Iran deal in 2018, restoring sanctions on the Islamic Republic. That was part of what Trump called a maximum pressure campaign, which has continued under his successor Joe Biden. Part of the campaign has resulted in business restrictions. But Iranian officials say the so-called pressure campaign has failed as Iran's oil exports has come closer to the figures prior to the reimposition of the sanctions. Statistical data also shows Iran's non-oil exports to the neighboring and friendly states have grown drastically in the past few years. Tehran has time and again blasted the U.S. for what it sees as addiction to sanctions. Based on a report in May 2022, Iran has between $100 and $120 billion trapped in foreign accounts because of the U.S. sanctions. The latest agreement between Tehran and Washington to release several billions of Iran's frozen assets is hailed as another example of an active and dignified diplomacy. Policies that the administration of Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, says are on its agenda to protect the rights of the Iranian people in any situation. And the latest deal is significant because it has preserved Iran's dignity as Tehran would not take the first step unless the U.S. shows its commitments under the deal. Also, it is the Islamic Republic that decides for which purposes it uses the unblocked funds, with the foreign ministry saying they would be used to meet the country's needs. The release of Iranian funds in South Korea comes after several billions of dollars of other Iranian assets frozen in Iraq were unblocked in July this year. Iran has time and again said it will continue to safeguard its rights and will never bow to outside pressure.
The U.S. publication has obtained a classified document suggesting Washington pushed for the removal of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan from office. The document has been published by The Intercept. According to the secret cable known internally as a cipher, The meeting took place on March 7, 2022, between the Pakistani ambassador to the U.S., Asad Majid Khan, and two State Department officials. During the meeting, U.S. officials, including the Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of South and Central Asian Affairs, Donald Liu, encouraged the Pakistani government to remove Imran Khan over his neutrality over the war in Ukraine. The day before the meeting, Khan addressed a rally and responded directly to European calls that Pakistan rally behind Ukraine. During that rally, Khan said Pakistanis were not slaves to the Europeans and Americans. He said, "We are friends of Russia, and we are also friends of the U.S. We are friends of China and Europe. We are not part of any alliance." 1 month after the meeting with U.S. officials, a no-confidence vote was held in Parliament, leading to Khan's removal from power. The vote is believed to have been organized with the backing of Pakistan's powerful military. The cable reveals both the carrots and the sticks that the State Department deployed in its push against Khan, U.S. officials promising warmer relations if Khan was removed. They also threatened Pakistan with isolation if Khan was not removed from power. The diplomatic meeting came 2 weeks after the war began between Russia and Ukraine. Before his ouster, Khan had already accused a quote foreign power of funding a conspiracy to topple his democratically elected government.
So I get this message. Donald Liu is telling the ambassador that unless Imran Khan is removed as the prime minister in the no confidence motion, there'll be consequences for Pakistan. It was a conspiracy. It was the army chief. It was the guy who's the prime minister right now. And the U.S. came into it as thinking as I'm someone anti-American. Some reason, if you don't agree with the U.S. foreign policy, you're turned anti-American. First, worry about your own people rather than getting involved in conflicts.
The unnamed foreign power was interpreted as a clear reference to the U.S. Following Khan's ouster from power, Pakistan plunged into a crisis. He was elected in July 2018, promising to fight corruption and to fix the economy. But those pledges went unmet, and the world's second-largest Muslim country was gripped by a financial crisis. After Khan's removal, his supporters took to the streets across Pakistan to show their support for the removed prime minister. Since his removal from power, about 200 court cases have been lodged against Khan by the military-backed government.
All my time is spent from going from one court to another courtroom. I have made, in 2 months, over 350 court appearances. And my legal team is busy fending off one case after the other. But the thing is, nothing sticks because these are frivolous, bogus cases. And what now they are planning to do is to have military courts. And this is right now in the Supreme Court, whether the courts will allow military courts or not. And the objective of the military court is that there I certainly will be sentenced.
The former prime minister has maintained that the cases against him are politically motivated to keep him out of power. He says the country's powerful military is behind these cases. Khan has been barred from holding public office for 5 years by the country's electoral authorities. The decision was announced by the Election Commission of Pakistan days after Khan was sentenced to 3 years in prison for corruption. Under Pakistani laws, a convicted person cannot run for public office for a period set out by the Election Commission of Pakistan.
The recent premature decision by the Election Commission of Pakistan is just another method for this unmandated government to try to eliminate Imran Khan from the political landscape of Pakistan. We must remember that Imran Khan was, is, and always will remain the chairman of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, the largest national level party in the country. Imran Khan's case against him from a session court will be reversed.
Khan is not the first Pakistani prime minister to be convicted of alleged corruption. It is believed the political system in Pakistan is widely mired in corruption, and none of the politicians and political parties have shown any desire to fix the system. On Thursday, Pakistan's parliament was dissolved on the recommendation of Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, making way for a general election amid political and economic crises. But the vote could be delayed several months, with the Election Commission set to start redrawing hundreds of constituencies based on a fresh consensus. Analysts have said any delay in the election could fuel public anger and add to uncertainty in the cash-strapped country.
Iran has hosted a conference dubbed Iran and BRICS Prospects for Partnership and Cooperation at the Foreign Ministry's Institute for Political and International Studies in the capital, Tehran. Officials from the ministry, as well as a group of foreign ambassadors residing in the Iranian capital, participated in the event, which aims at identifying mutual capacities between the sides. The BRICS group of fast-developing economies, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, is often seen as an alternative to Western economic and political hegemony. It accounts for 42% of the global population and about 26% of the world's economy. Addressing the conference, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian highlighted the significant role of BRICS in driving global economic growth, saying the Islamic Republic can be a reliable and influential partner of the five-member bloc of emerging economies.
The Islamic Republic of Iran is a reliable and effective partner in bilateral and multilateral cooperation due to its unique geostrategic situation and geographical location. It has massive energy sources, especially petroleum and gas, and it has an inexpensive and short transportation channel. The country has young, skilled, and professional workers and new and innovative scientific and technological resources.
The foreign minister hailed the favorable state of Iran's political and economic relations with BRICS members and underlined the need for all sides to further boost economic ties. He also stressed that BRICS represents a powerful economic and political synergy with the potential to influence regional and global developments. The BRICS summit will be held in Johannesburg, South Africa, on August 22nd to 24th. According to South African Foreign Minister Naledi Pandor, among the topics to be discussed at the BRICS summit will be the organization's expansion. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has received a formal invitation from South Africa to attend the summit. Iran is among dozens of countries that seek membership in the BRICS and has submitted a formal application to join the body. For decades after the Cold War, the world witnessed a U.S. unipolar hegemonic order. In recent years, however, a new multipolar world order has been emerging, with certain countries challenging the U.S.'s economic and political dominance. Also, perceptions of American arrogance and hypocrisy are widespread. Trust in the international systems that the U.S. helped invent and has presided over since World War II is long gone. After two decades of bloody military interventions across the West Asia, namely in Afghanistan and Iraq, the United States has lost much of its moral credibility as well. Russian and Chinese leaders have long expressed a desire for a more multipolar order, as have the leaders of emerging powers such as India or Brazil. So has Iran. And for the Islamic Republic, BRICS can be the next significant target of its multilateralism policy. According to the latest data released by the Islamic Republic of Iran Customs Administration, the value of Iran's non-oil trade with BRICS group of countries hits $38.43 billion in the 2022-2023 fiscal year, showing a 14% hike compared to the same period a year earlier. That's while the West, particularly the U.S., have imposed several rounds of unilateral sanctions against Tehran. Many states have been applying for membership in international bodies in a bid to promote multilateralism and counter unilateral policies. In addition, last month, Iran gained full membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the world's largest regional organization in terms of geographic scope and population. In an address to a meeting of the Friends of BRICS foreign ministers in Cape Town in June, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said Iran is among the pioneers of multilateralism. He added that the era of unilateralism is coming to an end and that the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the BRICS group of countries will play major roles in the future as a new world order is emerging. More than 3,000 United States military personnel have arrived in the Red Sea aboard two warships after Washington said it would boost its military footprint in the region amid rising tensions with Iran. The sailors arrived while traveling on the USS Bataan, an amphibious assault ship that can carry more than 20 aircraft, and on the USS Carter Hall landing ship. Both ships entered the Red Sea after crossing the Mediterranean Sea and passing through the Suez Canal. The reinforcements will secure existing air and naval assets of the 5th Fleet, which is based in Bahrain and operates in the Persian Gulf, the Red Sea, the Gulf of Oman, and the Indian Ocean, including critical strategic choke points in the Strait of Hormuz and Suez Canal. The move follows an announcement last week by U.S. military officials to deploy a security guard composed of Marines on board commercial tankers passing through and near the Strait of Hormuz to form an additional layer of defense for these ships. The U.S. Navy accused Iran of attacking, seizing, or attempting to seize nearly 20 internationally flagged merchant vessels in the region over the past 2 years. However, an informed Iranian defense source has told Iranian media that Tehran has made no efforts to seize oil tankers in the Persian Gulf, denying an earlier U.S. claim accusing Tehran of trying to take control of two ships. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Navy has over the past years foiled several attacks on both Iranian and foreign tankers in the strategic Persian Gulf region and other high seas. The IRGC's Navy confiscated more than 50 million liters of smuggled fuel, mainly diesel, in various missions last year. That's while the U.S. Navy has seized Iranian ships carrying oil in transit to China in recent months, in an effort to enforce U.S. sanctions on Iran that seek to harm the Islamic Republic's economy. In a Monday press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Nasser Kanani, said U.S. deployments are only serving Washington's interests.
The U.S. government's military presence in the region has never created security. Their interests in this region have always compelled them to feel instability and insecurity. We are deeply convinced that the countries of the Persian Gulf are capable of ensuring their own security.
Iran says it views U.S. military vessels lurking in the waters of the Persian Gulf as a threat to its security and a source of tension and instability in the region. The U.S. announced last month that it would deploy a destroyer, F-35 and F-16 warplanes to the West Asia. Last week, the U.S. military claimed it was considering putting armed personnel on commercial ships traveling through the Strait of Hormuz to stop Iran from harassing vessels. Tehran responded on Saturday by saying it was equipping its Revolutionary Guards Navy with drones and 1,000-kilometer range missiles. The IRGC also issued a warning to the United States, saying the Islamic Republic is powerful enough to respond in kind to any act of mischief by the U.S. in the region. Also, on 3rd of August, naval forces of the Iranian Islamic Revolution Guards Corps launched surprise military drills in the Persian Gulf islands of Abu Musa, Greater Tomb, and Lesser Tomb. The naval exercise was to display the IRGC Navy's might as well as combat and defense preparedness in protecting the Persian Gulf security and the Iranian islands. During the drills, various units of the IRGC were expected to exercise a range of military tactics. Iranian military experts and engineers have in recent years made remarkable breakthroughs in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient. Iranian officials have made clear that the country will not hesitate to strengthen its military capabilities, including its missile power, which are entirely meant for defense.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
France's colonial rule in Africa began in the 19th century. Many might think that the days of cruel exploitation, massacre, slavery, and psychological abuse of African people in the hands of the French have come to an end. But the recent developments in countries like Niger show Paris still has its hand over the continent. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. According to Tehran Times, the latest African country to rise up against French dominance is Niger, where the military managed to overthrow the Western-backed government of Mohamed Bazoum in July. Western regimes have resorted to their usual tactic and began a propaganda campaign against the coup, which in fact seems to enjoy the support of most Nigerian people. Instead of talking about why the coup has happened and what people had been demanding from the previous governments, the West has decided to reduce the event to an authoritative act and call it a threat against democracy. The American and European governments reacted exactly the same way when similar events happened in Mali and Burkina Faso in 2021 and 2022. The two countries, similar to Niger, finally drew a line in the sand and decided to root out French influence so that African people can determine the fate of their own nations. The people of Africa are fed up with being kept in poverty and struggling to put food on the table while France exploits their natural resources and fills its own pockets with African filth. The simple fact that Africans no longer want France's stealing is something you will never hear from Western media. To understand what's exactly been sidestepped by the West, we will be taking a look at France's colonial past in Africa and how it continues to exploit the continent today. The British and the French colonized 95% of the African continent at one point. France colonized 20 nations, including present-day Senegal, Mali, Burkina Faso, Benin, Guinea, Ivory Coast, and Niger, which are all located in West Africa. The tales of French colonization of West Africa are perhaps some of the most harrowing and chilling stories in the history of mankind. The French were notorious for resorting to extremely cruel and inhuman methods when things didn't go their way. They stripped African people of their clothes, put heavy chains on them, clipped their body parts to the wall, raped their women and children, and tortured them in ways unimaginable. We do not have to go far in history to encounter a horrifying act by the French, like how they used bones of Algerian people to make soap. France has committed enough crimes in recent past for us to fill up the entire page. During its 1.5 centuries of direct colonialism, France has killed hundreds of thousands of African people for different reasons. For instance, on the morning of December 1, 1944, French forces committed the Tiaroye massacre. They killed hundreds of Senegalese troops returning home after fighting in the Second World War once the soldiers demanded personal rights and payment. It was as if Senegalese people should have felt honored to simply fight and die for France in the war, and they were not allowed to ask for anything more. It is important to note that France has never paid compensation for any of the inhumane crimes it has committed. If you ask a French person today, they might laud their ancestors for bringing modernism to Africa and helping the people of the continent become more humane. Various renowned writers and historians have pointed out this notion that non-Western people are lesser than still prevails throughout Europe and the US. France still continues its colonialism of Africa through agreements and administrative practices. Paris loots the natural reserves of 14 African countries today, namely Benin, Burkina Faso, Guinea-Bissau, Ivory Coast, Mali, Niger, Senegal, Togo, Cameroon, Central African Republic, Chad, Congo, Brazzaville, Equatorial Guinea and Gabon. France has been earning hundreds of billions of dollars each year through these agreements. To understand the Western hype about the coup in Niger, we must know that at least 20% of France's nuclear electricity is generated by using the uranium ore it steals from the African country. After Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso, if the rest of these 40 nations decide to get rid of French dominance, the future of France's economy and welfare might lie in shambles. At the time of reading this article, Western governments are weighing the launch of an incursion into Niger to bring the government of Bazoum back. We must wait and see whether other states in West Africa would decide to function independently and finally help their own people, or would get militarily involved in Niger and allow France to continue looting Africa's resources.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on June 11, 2023, in a meeting with a number of scientists, specialists, experts, and officials of Iran's nuclear industry. Over the last 20 years, we have come to realize who is trustworthy and who is not trustworthy. So this was what I had to say about the importance of the nuclear issue. As I said, you probably know these things more than we do, but I want the people to know about these as well. The second issue that I want to outline is about the advancements that have been made in this industry in our country. Of course, I am not an expert in technical matters and don't have enough information in this area to speak about this. It is your job to shed light on these advancements, but I would like to speak about this matter in general. I would like to say one thing about this first. In our political language, we have words such as mustaz'af, the oppressed or underprivileged, and istaz'af, weakness. We say, for example, such and such nation is mustaz'af nation, or we were a mustaz'af nation before the revolution. The word mustaz'af is a profound, meaningful word.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
What is the meaning of mustaz'af? It refers to someone who has been kept weak. Mustaz'af is different from za'if or weak. Za'if means someone who is weak, but mustaz'af is someone who has been kept weak. Being kept weak, which is the meaning of the word mustaz'af, is of two types. There is a time when a world power comes, dominates a country, and keeps it weak. For example, there are colonial powers that kept the colonized countries weak, such as Britain. It kept the countries in the Indian subcontinent weak for so many years. If you refer to the book Glimpses of World History, written by Jawaharlal Nehru, the former Prime Minister of India, who was an informed, scholarly man, he explains what India was like before the arrival of the British and what happened after their arrival. He explains how India deteriorated, how impoverished it became. This is colonialism. Therefore, one type of istiz'af or weakness is when the world power holds a nation back, which is a bad thing. It is dangerous. What's even more dangerous is the second type of istiz'af, and that is when a nation itself believes that it is weak. When it believes that is incapable and that it cannot do anything. This is very dangerous.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
75 years after the forced displacement during the Nakba, Palestinian refugees are concerned about the dire financial crisis facing the UNRWA. Since its establishment in 1949 by the UN General Assembly, UNRWA has dedicated all its effort to help protect the Palestinian refugees by providing humanitarian services and supporting their education. 2023 marks the most dangerous year for over 5 million Palestinian refugees spread across the occupied territories, Jordan, Lebanon, and other countries.
UNRWA's financial crisis started since signings of the Oslo Accord. It is mainly a political crisis, not financial, aroused by the U.S. administrations and the EU. The crisis is worsening every year, especially in Gaza. The donor countries have defunded and stopped their aids.
Here is where Hatem Mehjez, a Palestinian refugee, father of eight, was born after his father was displaced. He and his family are facing a serious situation because of the shrinking of UNRWA's essential services.
After my father's passing, I continued to live with the same suffering. The UNRWA's food supplies are not sufficient anymore. I beg my neighbors to feed us because I can't support my family. I can't work due to the health issues. My wife is also ill, and the UNRWA's medical centers, which are responsible for providing health care to us, don't provide her with the medications needed.
Talking about the shrinking supplies, Hatim is expressing his concerns about the future of his sons, who couldn't afford to marry and have their own families, as they are trying to work hard to support their younger siblings.
My sons can barely find work due to Gaza's disastrous situation amid the prolonged Israeli blockade and the rapidly rising fuel and food prices. They can hardly manage to get cooking gas and electricity. Sometimes on days like today, we don't find food on our table the whole day.